My name is Martin Newman, and I'm the consumer champion. After 37 years in consumer-facing industries, believe me, I have seen it all. My goal is to play a role in providing consumers with a voice, to connect with brands that they've engaged with, and to help companies to learn from their customers where they're going right or where they're going wrong. You're joining me on Customer Centricity, the podcast. Each episode, you will find me in conversation with leading business people, discussing some of the key issues around how to empower positive change for consumers and brands. Before I introduce our guest for this episode, let me tell you a little bit more about customer service action. Just like you, I've been on the wrong end of some staggeringly bad customer service. We've all experienced it, haven't we? Whether it's the rude waiter or having to wait 40 minutes in a queue. And just like you again, I've also been delighted by an amazing experience when I wasn't expecting it. But aside from telling the manager or writing a rather awkward thank you note on TripAdvisor, what can you really do when something is great or when it's not so good? My frustration has always been not knowing how to raise these issues with the brand in question in the first place, or whether in fact I'd be even wasting my time by doing so. For these reasons, I launched Customer Service Action, a platform where people can share their good and their bad customer service stories and experiences in one impartial place. My vision is that we can collectively make a difference and create the change that consumers seek, and in turn help businesses too. Good customer service and good customer experience leads to successful brands. So please visit us at www.customerserviceaction.com to learn more. Thank you for joining my podcast. I'm Martin Newman and I am the consumer champion. I want to tell you a little bit about my journey and how I ended up being so passionate about customer centricity and all things customer centric, because my world really revolves very much around that. My journey started, I'd say, as a 6-year-old. My father, my late father, who had a small chain of optical practices in Glasgow, retail opticians, aka a small version of Specsavers. If only I knew what I knew then, I'd have maybe helped him grow Specsavers, but there you go. Didn't know that much as a 6-year-old. My dad used to take me into his optical practices at the weekend, and I just loved it. I loved seeing my dad interacting with patients, testing their eyes, coming out, selling them glasses, upselling them onto sunglasses. He was always investing in his optical practices as well, always continually evolving them and upgrading the shop fit and everything. And I used to spend quite a lot of money on that. And I always remember saying to him, you know, Dad, why are you doing that? You know, thinking, why are you spending, that could be a really nice holiday for us or whatever it happens to be. But he said to me, you know, if I don't do it, if I don't make sure that the experience is perfect and it's continually updated, then people will choose to go elsewhere. So I'd say this is really when I first became aware of kind of what customer centricity really entailed. And it was literally through my father investing in, continually upgrading his practices. So that was really my foray into customer centricity and me seeing firsthand, you know, what it really entailed. I subsequently went on, I left school, I didn't go to university. I probably wasn't even in school as often as I should have been, which is not something I'm necessarily proud of, but that's the way it was at that age. And I actually left school and went into my father's business. So I went on to work for him. And it was a great opportunity, obviously, to work for a family business, to cut my teeth in a customer service role, then in a marketing role, without the fear of being fired, which is always one of the most advantageous things of working for a family business, or at least that was the case for me at the time. I did that for a number of years, really enjoyed it. My dad wanted me to go back to university and do a degree in optics, and then maybe I would have been able to help him grow, build a business into Specsavers, but it wasn't for me. I spent a bit of time in travel and hospitality, and I also spent a bit of time working in the advertising agency sector. And it was when I was doing that I landed an opportunity to work with a retailer called Sports Connection, who are sadly no longer around, but were quite a significant player in their day. They were about the fifth largest in the UK. And that led me, long story short, that led me to then going in-house to work for another sports retailer you may have heard of called Intersport. So I got the opportunity to go back into retail, onto the client side of the fence, if you like. And I really missed that. And I very much enjoyed my tenure in those roles. If I fast forward, because there's a bit of stuff in the middle that's probably not as important, but if I fast forward a little bit, actually 1997, when I was sitting at my desk. I went from Intersport to Sports Connection to then be their marketing director. I was sitting at my desk in Glasgow in the Hillington Industrial Estate. And this was my first, the first time that I basically came across the internet. I couldn't even type. I had a big computer on my desk. I'd never switched it on because I didn't know what to do with it. But I did have a PA. And one day I slipped my head out the door and I said to my PA, can you tell me where such and such a document is? When can I get that? So I'd given her something to type up. And she was on the internet. I said, Louise, tell me about this web internet thing. And while you're at it, maybe give me a lesson on how to use my computer and how to send an email. And that was my kind of deep dive, if you like, or my light bulb moment into getting involved in the internet and also becoming a bit more sort of technology savvy. Not long after that, I had a go at setting up my first business. I set up a web development business in Glasgow. I started doing domain registration, domain names, then a bit of hosting, a bit of digital marketing, just at the same time, a little business called Google, you might have heard of them, were being founded. And then we went on to build websites, and we were building transactional websites, not just brochureware websites. And we did quite well, you know, made quite a bit of money for a couple of years, and then the .com crashed and burned, and I crashed and burned with it. Because unfortunately, at that time, there wasn't really such a thing as software as a service. So we were building websites and charging good money for them, but then giving them to the client. There was no recurring revenue, which was a bit of a fault on my part. But I learned my lessons a number of years later. Anyway, fast forward to 2004, I came down to London. I kind of missed the client side again, and I'd had this go at building my own business, which I did well for a couple of years, and then found a bit challenging, and I probably lost my confidence and thought maybe I'm not fit for purpose as an entrepreneur. I'll go back to my career. And I moved down to London with my family, and I landed an opportunity to run online and home shopping for a little store in the West End of London called Harrods, that you might have heard of. And that was a great experience, really enjoyed that. But subsequently, I had a succession of high profile roles running online at Harrods and catalogues and other aspects of the multi-channel proposition. I then went to Pentland Brands, then I went to Burberry, then I went to Ted Baker. And in all of those roles, I think it would be fair to say, although I was called head of e-commerce or head of multi-channel, I mean, fundamentally, I was like a mini managing director, because those brands at that time didn't really know what to do with digital or e-commerce. So I was kind of parked in a different part of the business, given my own resources and left to get on with it, acquiring customers, retaining them, you know, sorting out logistics, customer service, the technology, the platform, and so on. So as you would imagine, I learned an awful lot in that period. I was also an early adopter and always liked to be seen as one. So I was very quick and early to market with lots of new technologies, things like live chat, which I will talk about later, which most websites have today. Around that time, I think it's fair to say, I built a reputation for being able to optimize and maximize sales online. So I'm very commercial and I'm very commercially focused, but my commerciality is very much pragmatically based. In other words, I've got an innate ability to understand the barriers that get in the way of stopping people from buying stuff. So I probably was seen as a bit of a website usability expert, a marketing expert, and so on and so forth. But to be honest with you, when I think back on it, it's not so much that I necessarily felt that I really understood the sort of science of any of those disciplines in themselves better than anyone else. But what I did understand is customer behavior. And I understood what customer needs and wants were, and therefore what we would need to do as an organization in order to make it easier, you know, for people to buy. I got an opportunity. I was starting a little business called Practicology, which became quite a big business over a 9-year period. Started as me, it was a consulting practice, an advisory business, mainly around e-commerce, telling people how to do a better job of selling stuff, giving them advice on their structure, their technology, their marketing, advising them on what countries to go into after the UK, how to internationalize, and so on and so forth. And I grew that business to basically the best part of 100 people over a 9-year period, but I'll come back to that in a minute. I was presenting at an event called E-Commerce Expo in London in 2009. I got a tap on the shoulder by a guy called Mark Harvey, who ran online retailer in Australia, which was the big event in Australia. He said, "Ah, mate, you go down really well down under." in my terrible Australian accent, which I should be able to do a little bit better given I've been there 22 times. Anyway, I ended up going down to Australia the next year in 2010. And I have to, I did become quite well known in the space because e-commerce was a little bit behind where we were in the UK. I was this kind of evangelist coming in with quite a lot of experience from the UK, talking about how they could, again, optimize their websites, optimize marketing and everything else. And I was doing these workshops in front of 250, 300 people on my feet the whole day, doing live website reviews, telling them how they could make it easier for people to buy things and everything. I really enjoyed it. It subsequently led to us growing a business down there, brought somebody on to run the business there, who subsequently replaced me many years later because he did such a good job of building the business in Australia and taking us into other markets. All of my passion around customer centricity has led to me writing books, as he reaches up to his shelf up here. And this is the first book that I wrote in 2017 that was published in 2018, called 100 Practical Ways to Improve Customer Experience. I was very privileged to have a very well-known marketing professor, not a footballer, called Malcolm McDonald, who's in his 80s, but an incredibly experienced man, brilliant writer, orator, and comedian probably as well. Taught me a few good or a few bad jokes. And Malcolm sort of, he wrote the subnote or the footer to the end of each of the chapters in the book. The book did really well. And it was my first attempt at describing what it meant to be customer-centric, because I thought, crikey, I've spent years talking about this stuff, talking about putting customers first, talking about putting customers at the heart of everything we do, talking about being customer-centric. What does it actually mean in totality? Not just in terms of customer experience, but how do you go about delivering this? So that was my first effort at doing that. I'll jump about a little bit, but it'll all make sense, hopefully. So coming back to Practicology, we grew Practicology to nearly 100 people. We started in London. We then went to Australia, as I've outlined. We then opened up, Chris convinced me to open an office in Hong Kong and then China, which was a great move, and latterly in Dubai. And then we had the good fortune to sell the business to a company called Pattern, who are one of the world's leading, not just marketplace, but primarily marketplace enablers. They're a reseller. They essentially take on the stock risk from most of the clients they work with, and they do a great job of getting traction and sales on Amazon and all main marketplaces around the world. We just happened to be in all the right places that they wanted to be in, so it gave them a quicker route to market. And I've got a very good relationship with that business today. Chris subsequently stayed on and now runs the international side of that business. And it provided the opportunity for me to essentially move on, but as I say, still have a relationship with the company. What have I done in the last few years as well that might be interesting to bring up? I've been a board advisor to the leading buy now, pay later provider globally called Afterpay, in the UK and Europe known as Clearpay. So they do have the most engagement in the UK today. They are the clear market leader in Australia and the clear market leader in the States. And they are a facilitator, essentially a great payment method for Gen Z millennials. You may not know that they have a much lower propensity to want to use credit cards and to build up debt. Therefore, they like to use cash. Buy now, pay later gives them access to products when they want them. They don't pay any interest for that. That's picked up by the brand. So it's a very consumer-centric product, which is why I'm very happy to be involved. I love the business and have been involved for a few years. When I left Pattern at the end of 2018, I had to start again. And to be honest with you, I'd never given two thoughts to what would I do after Practicology, because whilst my objective was to build the business and sell it at some point in time, I never allowed myself to get, I don't like getting ahead of myself. So I never allowed myself to kind of dream of what might I do if I'm ever successful in achieving that. So really, I literally, when Dave, the founder of Pattern, and I kind of agreed it might make sense for me just to move on, you know, I did have to literally sit down and think, what the heck am I going to do? I thought, well, I might as well stick to what I'm good at, which is customer centricity, customer service, customer experience. It's my passion. I think I'm pretty good at it. And I started building something from scratch. And essentially, the output of that was a website which exists today called customerserviceaction.com. And I want to be a force for positive change. So I think with my knowledge of consumers, my knowledge of business, I'm quite well placed to bring the two parties together in a more collaborative way than we've maybe done so before. So when customers have an issue, it might be a customer service issue, or they have something they want to compliment a brand about, they can do this on customerserviceaction.com. What we're doing now is we're actually taking the technology and we're enabling brands to integrate it into their own website for this to become an independent pathway in to their own customer service experience through their channels. More about that maybe another day. All of this led me to thinking, I need to update my framework. I think I've wrote a pretty good book, you know, a few years ago, but maybe now's the time to write another book. And so in 2020, I wrote this book called The Power of Customer Experience, which was published in May 2021. So I finished writing it at the end of last year and it was published just a few months ago. And you'll see there the byline, how to use customer centricity to drive sales and profitability. And interestingly, on my Facebook memories, up popped a memory from 2014 when I was doing a keynote presentation at the London School of Economics just the other week. Literally, this came up. It was a seven-year anniversary. And I was sharing a stage with a lady called Laura Wade Geary, who used to run multi-channel M&S. She's now a plural CEO and non-exec director. At the time, arguably the most experienced and probably best known multi-channel director in the industry. She did a keynote, I did the next one. And the name of my presentation was literally how to use customer centricity to drive sales and profitability. I'd actually forgotten about that, to be honest, when I came up with that as the byline for the book. But this book, not only is it an updated framework, but it's all about what's the commercial value, what's the commercial impact of being customer centric. And the reason for that is I get deeply frustrated when I talk to businesses, because all the time I hear about businesses talking about the cost to serve. Oh, the cost to serve customers is too high. Well, guess what? If that's the focus, then I guarantee that as a business that isn't focused on customer lifetime value and maximizing that. So I thought, well, I need to write a book that businesses can refer to so they can see the case studies from businesses all over the world that do this stuff well and what the commercial impact and the uplift and the positive outcome is for their organization. Moving on from the book, I'm very privileged. I have some non-exec work and other advisory board stuff that I do. So I'm the non-exec chair of the retail arm of the Scouts called Scout Store, which I've been doing for just over a year, which I really enjoy. I'm also privileged to be the chair of the advisory board of an amazing consumer goods business called Mayborn. And Mayborn has a number of brands. The best known that hopefully most of you will have heard of is Tommy Tippy. So if you have kids or you're young enough, you never know, you may have supped from the Tommy Tippy cup at some point in your life. So I very much enjoy that. I'm also an investor. I make a few investments, generally speaking, in customer-centric propositions. So, for example, I've invested in the first driverless vehicle to actually get a license from the UK government to test on the roads, and it's a company called Cargo, K-A-R-Go. So they're a driverless logistics proposition for the last mile experience. So we'll see how that plays out. But I do a few of those things as well, which I find quite interesting. I've had, like you, I'm sure, lots of good and bad experiences. I get lots of good and bad customer service experiences and customer experience on a regular basis. And I've got a very heightened awareness to all of this. But I thought I would just tell you a few stories to give you an idea of kind of my passion and I suppose where these things can become a real issue for customers. A number of years ago, I was in Miami and it was coming up for my 20th wedding anniversary. And we were in the Bal Harbour Shopping Centre, which is an upmarket shopping centre in Miami. And we're going round and I'm looking at all these really expensive brands and fascias. And I'm thinking, crikey, I can't afford anything in here, being a minor from Glasgow. And we happened upon this store called Balenciaga. I have to show my ignorance and say that 7 years ago, I hadn't heard of Balenciaga, despite being quite a brand-led man. So I don't know where my head's been. It must have been stuck in the sand to not know that brand. Anyway, we walked in the door and my wife and kids picked up this beautiful clutch bag. And I knew immediately what this was all about. This was about expensive handbags. Now, given that it was coming up for my 20th wedding anniversary, I said to my wife, Laura, all right, it's a big number. Do you want this for your anniversary present? And she said, no, 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 no. In fact, if you buy that for me, I'll be really angry with you. As you'll be able to tell now, I'm a man who reads women's minds because I knew what she actually meant was, yes, 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 but don't you dare buy it for me now. You must surprise me. In other words, you buy it for me when we get back home. I'd worked that one out quite quickly. So we came back home on a Sunday and Wednesday is my anniversary. So I've essentially got between Monday morning and Tuesday night, to get this. I remembered, obviously remembered Selfridges. So I looked online, I looked on my phone first of all to see whether I could get to Selfridges physically, and I couldn't because I was rammed. So I thought, I'll buy it online. And at that time, Selfridges couldn't offer me their delivery proposition. So I thought, well, Selfridges can't deliver the experience I'm looking for. So I'm going to find someone else. So I obviously Googled it, and then I found Matches Fashion. And Matches Fashion could deliver it between 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock on the Tuesday evening. Job done. Perfect. Thought, better just check my phone again. Check my phone again, and I'm out for dinner with a really important client. It's taken me months to get this in the diary. There's no way I'm cancelling it. So I phoned the contact centre of Matches Fashion, explained my predicament, and I said, can you deliver that on Tuesday night, rather, between 8 and 9 o'clock, not between 6 and 9. I guarantee I'll go home for them. And I explained the situation. And the guy in the call centre said, I'm really sorry, sir, but our courier doesn't offer that proposition. I'm like, say that again? This is a £1,200 bag we're talking about. So I gave him my name, I gave him my number, and I said, will you do me the courtesy of asking the question? Certainly, Mr. Newman. Do you think he even called me back? No. I still bought the bag. I got lucky. I got home at 7:30, and it turned up not long after that. Unbeknown to him, because he wouldn't even have known that I had made the acquisition in the first place. He didn't bother phoning me back. And I got in touch with Ruth Chapman, founder of Matches Fashion, and I said to Ruth, that's about one thing and one thing only. That's about staff empowerment, and it's about the culture. And you've created a culture where people are scared to do the right thing, or they don't know that they're empowered to be able to do the right thing, which is to say, do you know what? I'll find a way of getting that back to you. Even if I have to bring it in a taxi myself, or jump in my own car, or book a separate courier, or whatever it is, we'll get it to you between those hours, because it's a pretty expensive purchase. Anyway, that's what that was. And Ruth took that insight and very much changed the service orientation and culture of the business, much to their success. So I'll take a wee bit of credit for that at least. But that's really all that was. And Ruth was gracious enough to allow me to interview her and talk about that case study, which is in my first book rather than the second one. Think about buying a car. Why is it? I don't know about you, but I take a car out on a contract on PCP, or one of those type of hire purchase plans, if you like. I don't really want to necessarily own the car because I'll just give it back at the end if I've got a wee bit of equity in it, and I'll use that as a down payment for the next one. Anyway, I take these out normally for 3 or 4 years. And yet during that 3 or 4 year period, you virtually never hear from the brand at all. Even if you're lucky enough to have a high-end mark, you might get a brochure from the brand that you've bought, but you don't get any communication from the dealership. Why don't you? Why are they not contacting you? Why are they not trying to build a relationship? Why did they not even ask who else is in your life that we might sell a car to? Because all of a sudden, there could be a real referral opportunity there for them. They don't do any of that. It's really, really poor. So I don't think it matters what sector you look at. Customer service, customer experience, and a real lack of focus on customer lifetime value exists in every consumer sector I can think of. When was the last time you went into a restaurant and that restaurant kept in regular contact with you, personalized the communication based on what you like, you know, trying to build your loyalty, trying to increase the frequency of which you came back to that restaurant? You know, it really doesn't happen. It happens very infrequently. There are very few chains or even independent brands for that matter that have made the effort to do this. Why wouldn't you? If it was your business, why wouldn't you want to do everything you could to make sure I came back and my family came back as frequently as possible? So I started my career essentially 38 years ago, as I said, on the shop floor of my father's retail optical practices. And as I hope I have demonstrated up until now, I'm deeply passionate about customer service. I'm deeply passionate about customer experience, and I have lived and breathed it. And it has been at the heart of everything I've done. So if I think back to my time at Harrods, at Burberry, at Pentland Brands, and Ted Baker, there are many examples of things that I did where I think I demonstrated that I walked the talk. I didn't just talk it, I walked it. I implemented kiosks at Ted Baker because I understood that there was an opportunity to have this kind of endless aisle where you're limited by shelf space. Why not provide customers with the ability to buy from a broader range of products, aka the website, or straight from the distribution center? I implemented live chat. I had no end of difficulty, by the way, getting that through or past the boards at Ted Baker because, you know, and I understand why, because the pushback was, why would anybody want to engage with somebody in the customer service team to talk about, you know, what they're buying? I can understand why it would work for a technical product. And I said, because we all need reassurance. And sometimes somebody just wants to know, is my bum going to look big in this? Whatever it happens to be. And it had a big impact. And it's a very prominent feature in their website today, you know, 14 years down the line. So I've been an early adopter of lots of these things, ratings and reviews, you know, you name it. I implemented specified date delivery when I was at, I think I did it when I was at Harrods. I certainly did it when I was at Ted Baker. Why did I do that? Because I recognized we had quite a lot of gift buyers and gift givers. And being able to specify a date when somebody gets the gift, aka my story a minute ago about Balenciaga handbags, that was the whole proposition, if you like, behind that, is that they couldn't specify the right time and date for me to make sure that I knew I was going to have it in my hands before the anniversary and that wouldn't turn up late. So the reason why I wrote the book, The Power of Customer Experience, is that, again, I've not seen anything prior previous book that describes how you go on this journey to transform your business to be truly customer centric. And more importantly today, what is the commercial value and the impact of doing that? Which is also why I've gone on to create a mini MBA in customer centricity with my partners, the Oxford College of Marketing and the Oxford College of Leadership and Management, because I want to put tools in the hands of people that they can take this back to their business to make the change, to be more customer centric, to drive customer lifetime value, to reduce customer churn. It's so much more profitable to convince a really small number of existing customers to buy again than it is to go and acquire a whole much bigger bunch of new customers, because most of them will just fall out of a leaky bucket and won't come back and buy again. I'm going to leave by talking about my six key reasons for that I think are the important drivers for creating a customer-centric roadmap in the first place that will hopefully take you in the right direction. First is not having a focus on the cost to serve, but having a focus on customer lifetime value. If you focus on the cost to serve, it will be a race to the bottom, because what will happen is you'll make decisions about cutting out costs. So the CEO will say to you, as the e-com director, the digital director, the chief customer officer, the head of e-commerce, the head of stores, whatever your role is, I need you to cut costs. So what happens when you look at your contact center business and you go, do we really need 100 people in there answering the phone? No, we'll take a knife to 20% of our headcount there. Oh, and over here, do we really need that new platform that we were looking at implementing that was going to be, you know, give us that sort of extra power we were looking for to deliver better customer service? Now, we'll just put that one on hold for now. So you basically end up making decisions that end up being at the detriment of the consumer. And guess what happens? It's complete cause and effect. Therefore, consumers churn, and they churn in higher numbers than they probably churned before. So you do the opposite. Rather than driving customer lifetime value, then you end up on a hamster wheel, and you end up having to plow more and more money into the top of the funnel, into acquisition marketing, to bringing people in. And you might tick the box of ROAS, return on advertising spend, but then there's no lifetime value because people don't come back because they don't get the right experience that they're looking for. So the first thing is focus on lifetime value and not on the cost to serve. Please, please, please. The second is to say that, honestly, I think I can look at every single consumer-facing business that has failed in the past 25 years, or at least every consumer-facing business of note, brands that you would recognize that have failed. And I genuinely believe you can bring it all back to a lack of customer centricity in a number of areas. Whether that's because, you know what, they just weren't selling the right products or services anymore. Think back to Blockbuster. I used to go to Blockbuster Video every Friday night. I was always excited about it. Go there, get my three for the price of two. I get some tubs of ice cream. I get some chocolate and some sweets. And we'd be lined up for what we were going to watch over the weekend. And then, of course, that became, you know, DVDs. And they just lost sight. They weren't close enough to customers. So they didn't see how customer behavior was changing. They didn't see the rise of Netflix and on-demand content, or people now engaging online to secure their DVDs. They were too slow to change. They were even offered the opportunity to buy Netflix in 2001 for $50 million. Well, they didn't. And sadly, you know, a decade later, they went out of business. Who would have imagined Toys R Us would have ever gone out of business? The biggest toy retailer in the world. The list goes on. There's a plethora of brands that have gone out of business because either they didn't sell the right product, they didn't have the right service, they didn't invest in digital and e-commerce and see the channel migration and the opportunities through that. They didn't join up their channels. to have an omni-channel sort of, you know, single view of the customer type experience, where they could make sure that customers got the right experience no matter where they started and finished their journey. They weren't focused on delivering the right level of convenience. Marketing was always focused on the top of the funnel and not on loyalty, not on building customer lifetime value, not on giving people reasons to continue to come back, and so on and so forth. And the problem with all of this is as well, even just at a product level, you know, 1994 was the first e-commerce transaction, but e-commerce has basically driven proliferation of choice. Prior to 1994, as a consumer, you had limited choice. You had high street stores, you had online, you had high street stores, you had the odd catalogue, or you had a retail park to go to, a retail park and maybe an out-of-town shopping centre. But that was it. In terms of brand choice, it was pretty limited. Whereas now, if you don't like the experience you've had with any given brand in any given sector, there are thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands of choices, literally a couple of clicks of your mouse away, and almost instantaneously. So there is nowhere to hide now, and consumers are very smart. They know that they hold the balance of power. So you've got to work harder than ever to convince them to give you their loyalty. The next is about putting your own people first. Because I think if you put your people first, they will go the extra mile, and they'll go the extra mile every time. I've recently conducted some mystery shopping, and I went across all the leading grocers and all the leading DIY retailers in the UK for a training in technology brand called Exonify. What they do is they provide bite-sized sort of a learning and development and training for staff on the front line, so they can very quickly on a daily basis stay on top of what they're meant to focus on. And I tell you what, I mean, this experience for me, I was really quite shocked. As somebody who started their career on the shop floor and has obviously spent many, many, many experiences being on the shop floor, talking to consumers, selling to consumers over the years in different environments. And I was shocked because nobody tried to sell me anything. I thought, this is a bit strange. You know, people on the front line of retail are there to sell and they're there to serve. They're not there purely to stack shelves. And that's what it felt like. And I think we've lost sight of the opportunity and what these people are there to do. There's all this talk about artificial intelligence. The robots should be stacking the shelves. The human beings should be selling to human beings and delivering the type of experience that we're all looking for. And I think when you think about the retail sector and you look at it in a very pragmatic sense, we don't really look after our people particularly well. We pay them minimum wage. Sometimes we give them 0-hour contracts. Worse still, sometimes we sack them and then rehire them on poorer commercial terms. And yet we expect these people to go the extra mile, to do cartwheels, to deliver the right experience for customers. We don't train them. We don't develop them. We don't prove to them that there's a succession plan. When I was growing up in retail, you know, the Sir Terry Leahys of Tesco and people like that, Andy Bond, you know, these people were coming through the ranks. You know, they were starting on the shop floor, wherever they started in those businesses. And they could progress all the way, you know, to CEO. Honestly, somebody starting in a retail business today, what are the chances of that happening? I'd say almost next to zero. So I really feel we've lost a lot of what retail's meant to be about, and the power of the people who work in our organizations, and even more so those who work on the front line. The next is about trust. And if customers don't trust you, they're obviously not going to keep buying from you. And lack of trust, I think, is a massive driver of customer churn. So customer-centric businesses, I believe, that are being socially responsible, are caring for the environment, are caring for their staff, are putting them first, are creating the right environment for them, are looking after them, and all of the above. And they treat all of that not as a tick box exercise that they have to sort of say on the annual report, you know, we'll be socially responsible by 2050, kicking the can down the road to buy time. They're doing something about it, and they can prove that. And I really believe that consumers will increasingly look to engage with brands who are seen to be doing the right thing. And that includes being diverse and being inclusive businesses. And to be diverse, it means being diverse and inclusive for people at all levels of the business. And this is both morally the right thing to do, but it's also very practically and commercially the right thing to do. Because just think about this for a minute. If you're selling to consumers and you have a board of directors, for example, who are all pale, male and stale, pale, male, definitely not stale. But if that's what your board of directors looks like, and there's no ethnicity and there's no gender, you know, a diversity on the board, and there's nobody with a disability, then guess what? You're going to do a pretty bad job, I think, of coming up with a value proposition, product, services, marketing, and customer experience that's going to be right for those brands, which is another reason why I think a lot of businesses struggle today. So there's a real impetus and real commercial reason for doing this. Now, you heard me mention there disabled consumers. There are 14 million disabled consumers in the UK. 14 million. Most people don't realize that. And yet, I talk to them all the time. I talk to disabled consumers all the time. And I can tell you from firsthand experience that more often than not, if you have a guide dog because you're, you know, you have serious visual impairment, you get turned away. There are people working on the front line who don't realize it's actually against the law to do that. But not only that, you know, morally, how can somebody go shopping if they can't, if they're blind or almost blind and they're not allowed to use their guide dogs? You know, or how do you cater for people that have complete hearing impairment? You know, how many people in a retail business or a restaurant or any others for that matter are able to lip read or are able to sign, you know? And if you can't do that, then how are you going to communicate with these people? So anyway, bottom line is diversity is massively important. Social responsibility is massively important. Looking after your people and your own people is massively important. And these are not things that you can pay lip service to. There are things that you have to prove you are walking the talk, and they're not just there on your annual report as a tick box exercise. The next is about the fact that commercially successful businesses, I believe, have an inept ability to turn customers into fans. Now, I've had this debate many, many times with many, many people. And of course, I'm not going to sit here and suggest that every single business in every single sector and every single category can realistically expect to have fans at the end of it. But I can tell you something. There's a brand called AO.com, Appliances Online, as they used to be known. You won't find too many customers of theirs who don't think of themselves as fans, who aren't the advocates or who are detractors. They're just not, because their level of service is fantastic, because they measure the people who install their fridge freezers and their tumble dryers by customer satisfaction, not by volume. So they focus on all the right measures and they do all the right things and they deliver the right experience. And when they get it wrong, they hold their hands up. That's why brands like that are successful. Brands like Home Depot, the B&Q, the DIY sector in North America, who empower their store staff to give $50 discounts to customers in order to sell to them. Remember that? Selling to customers, crikey, that's a new one. In order to drive the sale, that's what they do. They empower their staff. They also look after them in times of financial emergency. So what you find with these businesses is they just have this, it comes from the top, because culture comes from the top at the end of the day in all these companies. But they understand what it means to be a business with a good purpose, with a good heart, with the right values, and to do the right thing. And ultimately, when you do all of that, and you make an effort to engage with your customers in a more meaningful way, guess what? You actually do start to turn customers into fans. The example I always use, because it's just such a good one, and I find it hard to find a better one, is my local barbers in Cockfosters in North London, near where I live. So I get what's left of my hair, receding at a rate of knots. What's left of my hair, I get my hair cut there every few weeks. And these are four Greek Cypriot barbers, okay? Four Greek Cypriot barbers. And they have built a global brand. Go onto Instagram and search for Eagle Barbers. And you'll find that they've got more than 230,000 followers on Instagram. And it's one barbershop. I'm like, how the heck did they manage to do that when there are some household name brands that don't have a fraction of that level of engagement? That's because they cut good hair. Exclude mine from this conversation. They cut good hair. They deliver great content. They're authentic. They often post stuff on Instagram just about themselves, having a laugh in the shop and so on and so forth. They now go around the world, or they were prior to the pandemic and will be again shortly. They go around the world delivering training on stage to thousands of people. They literally go out in Brazil and America. There's 3,000 people in this auditorium and they're treated like rock stars when they come out on stage. And these people are there just to meet them and see them and watch them cutting hair. Half of them don't even work in the hairdressing or barbering industry, but they just created these kind of personas for themselves. It's just amazing. And the sixth is that successful businesses measure the inputs, not the outputs. I have sat in thousands of trading meetings on a Monday morning when I was back in the sports trade at Intersport, Sports Connection. When I was working with my dad, we would do it on a Monday. We would look at what was happening and how we performed the week before in marketing and everything else. When I was in e-commerce with Harrods and Burberry and Pentland and Ted Baker, you know, and you sit there on a Monday and you spew out conversion rates, average order values, units per transaction, traffic, dwell time, abandonment rates, footfall in the stores, you name it, more KPIs than you can shake a stick at. The problem with all of them is none of them, including even sales, right? What does sales tell you? It tells you how you're performing, but it doesn't tell you why you're performing, nor do any of those other metrics. If your conversion rate is 100% up on last week or 75% down on 2 weeks ago, it's like, so what? Why is it up or why is it down? And how do you get to understanding that? And I believe you need to be focusing on things like Net Promoter Scores, CSAT, customer satisfaction. What are customers calling the contact center about? What are they emailing them about? What are they saying on live chat? You know, what can you learn from that? Because that's normally the first touch point when stuff goes wrong. So the team that are running that operation have incredible insight to share on the business about products, services, and experiences that could be improved. You know, these are the things that really matter, not the actual performance or the output. Yes, you need to know it. Yes, you obviously need to report on it. But ultimately, they're only outputs. They're not the inputs. And the inputs are the things that will give you the insight to be able to make corrective actions and to be able to improve your performance. As I hope I've done a half decent job of demonstrating during this podcast, and in my book, The Power of Customer Experience, you know, there is a real correlation between brands who do this stuff well. They are sustainably successful year after year after year. Yes, you can throw examples at me of brands who are probably successful right now, who maybe might do the opposite, might actually be the opposite of customer-centric. You might look at them and think, they're not that friendly a brand, but they're quite successful. I guarantee you in the long run, they won't be. And when you look at the businesses that have gone bust over the last 25 years, as I said earlier, the majority of them went bust because they just didn't understand this stuff. They weren't focused on customers, they weren't customer-centric, and they weren't doing everything that they could to achieve that, which is why, again, I've created my mini MBA in customer centricity. So I hope you'll consider getting your hands on the book, which you can get from Amazon and all good bookstores. But I also hope you'll consider coming on the mini MBA because you'll find it a great investment of your time. We run it over 3.5 months. I guarantee you at the end of it, you'll understand this stuff with your eyes shut. And more importantly, you know, whether you're looking to transform your business as an entrepreneur or whether you have the ownership of customers within your business and you want to drive more meaningful change for customers because you recognize the commercial opportunity that presents, or whether you just are aspiring to do that type of job in the future in your career, you'll find the mini MBA in customer centricity a great investment of your time. If you want to know more, please go to www.martinnewman.co.uk/MBA. Thank you very much. If you would like to know more about what we're doing at Customer Service Action, the platform where people can share their good and bad customer service stories and experiences in one impartial place, then please visit customerserviceaction.com. Please remember to subscribe on your favorite podcast app so you can be notified when we go live with future episodes. Thank you so much for joining us today on Customer Centricity with me, Martin Newman.